very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he is so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Salaamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Rishahri. And in the studio with us is our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiyah of Qom. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. Thanks for coming to the program.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah, the pleasure is all mine.
So we have an interesting question coming in today. It reads, my husband takes my son to mosque and other religious programs, but I realize that at times he would hit my son if he misbehaves. Lately my son told me he doesn't want to go with his father anymore. So basically, this child is obviously doing something that the parent feels needs punishment, but they're applying physical punishment. What other methods can these parents use that will not have negative effects on a child's desire to go to a mosque?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First and foremost, it's important to realize that in Islamic child upbringing, the solution of hitting a child is actually done at a very, very last stage, basically. You rarely come to a situation where you need to hit your child. The situations where violence is required is extremely rare. In 99.9% of cases, you can solve the issue, you can correct a behavior without the need to use violence. And if you look at our riwayat and our traditions, we find that this is clearly mentioned to us. Very interesting, for example, we have many hadith that talk about what name to give to your child. And in some of these hadith, if you give the name of Fatima, for example, to your daughter, then make sure you don't hit her because of this name. Or for example, hadith of 145. So the Prophet says, if you name anybody Muhammad, anyone Muhammad, then do not disgrace him, do not frown at him, and do not beat him. Or for example, hadith number 148, towards the end, the Messenger of Allah says that, be careful, since you have named her Fatima, you should not insult her, nor curse her, nor beat her. So basically, any opportunity to encourage us to make sure that we don't reach to the point of violence. As for what you mentioned, if it's done well, then you should bring into this child this pride of being called Muhammad and Fatima, and encourage the positive aspect that you learn from this, right? So rather than the child misusing or using the opportunity to do bad things, you actually teach them that I'm not hitting you because you're called Muhammad, but that comes with the love that we want you to have for Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or the good habits that we want to learn from our Messenger of Allah. So it becomes a matter of pride. Like when you tell children, for example, you know why you were called Muhammad? Because of this great man, and because you also can become like him, right? Or you know why you were named Fatima? Because your path is becoming like that noble lady. And that brings a lot of respect, a lot of courage, a lot of motivation to do good and to behave, actually.
All right, let's take a break now, and after the break we'll be back to discuss other alternative methods that one can use to punish their children when they misbehave. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Brother Miqdad. We're talking about parents who hit their children for their misbehavior. And one of the disadvantages of such practice is that the child might not like to go to their parents to religious events, which harms their religious identity. So you explained that in Islam, it's very, very rare that anybody would need to use aggression against their children. It's 99.9% of the times you don't need to go that far. What are other alternative methods that parents can use to punish their children when they misbehave? In just before the break, you also said that you mentioned a hadith where if the Prophet said to someone that because your child is named Muhammad, you shouldn't even frown at him, which makes the options very narrow and hard.
Yes. Before we go to that, there's something you mentioned about the negative association that will come for a child if he's beaten, for example, because of misbehaving at mosque or in religious programs and events. This is one very, very dangerous consequence, a consequence that we need to be very wary of, that if we are using violence, for example, or any sort of cause that will lead to a negative association with religious programs, you're doing a very big disservice to this religious upbringing of the child. And this is something that we need to take care of, definitely. And we have many cases of adults, for example, if you ask them, why do you feel negative about coming to mosque, or why don't you like coming to, for example, religious center, you find that many cases will say that events that happened in my childhood in relation to mosque, for example, elders of the mosque telling me off because I was running around, or for example, my parents forcing me and beating me for coming to mosque, or telling me to sit down and not do anything. These negative memories of a mosque right now makes me feel like I don't want to go to such a place. And that's actually it's a very important consequence, because adults up until like 20 years, 30 years down the line, they still have the same feeling about mosque. So we need to be very, very careful regarding this. Let me mention other consequences of hitting your child or becoming physical. One of them is self-respect. A child that is beaten, a child that is hit, even it might be very little, can lead to or will lead to a very low self-confidence, at a very low level of self-respect. Because at the end of the day, you've hit a child, you've actually disgraced a child, you've actually humiliated a child, you've actually shown that this child has no respect, basically, or no value, because you've used something that portrays this message very strongly. And you find that children who are abused at home, children who are beaten by their parents, children who are even rarely, but in public, for example, smacked or pushed around, they're children whose self-confidence is very, very weak. And at times, it's interesting, we have cases where their confidence is so low, but however, their attachment to those same parents is very, very strong. You find that these children, they love their parents so much, despite the fact that they're being beaten by their parents.
That was actually one of the questions that I wanted to ask, but you just answered that. Let's take a short break, and after the break, we'll be more for further discussions on this topic. Don't go away.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
يا مقي الخيرات
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about parents who beat their children for misbehavior and how this can cause a negative association for religious events. Children will not want to go to religious events at all. One question here is that why is the association only with religious events? Why is it not with going to theme parks or going to other gatherings and parties? Why is it so focused on just religious events?
Let me get to that. Let me finish the point before the break. I was talking about children who actually will, you find these just children who are, despite being beaten by their parents, despite being hit by their parents, actually full of love for their parents. And this usually stems from a lack of security because they've got nowhere else to go. And they feel therefore so attached to their parents. And this actually is an exaggeration of attachment. It's a very dangerous and very unhealthy attachment that these children have with their parents, and you find that this leads to negative consequences later on. These are children that are very unsocial. They can't hold a position in society. They can't hold a relationship with others. Their confidence is very, very weak. So a second very negative consequence that happens when we hit our children is that their self-respect is destroyed. And we've said many times that self-respect has a direct cause with journey towards Allah, towards becoming a good believing Muslim. Another consequence that will happen with children being beaten is anxiety. Children with parents that hit them will feel constantly anxious, scared, fearful, and this is a psychological consequence that will happen from this. And obviously it leads to a lot of different diseases, mental states, psychological issues that will come up later on, basically. And again, something we need to be very, very wary of, very, very careful of, not to create or not to build anxiety in children. Children need to be children in the sense that they need to be free, happy, bubbling, joyous, full of life, basically. The moment we start hitting our children, even if it's on occasions, what happens is that children build anxiety. They can't predict their parents' behavior. They can't predict their parents' reactions. They don't know when my dad or my mom is going to get angry, I'm going to get beaten. And this creates a lack of security, and they feel anxious. If I do this, perhaps I'll get told off. If I do that, I'll get told off and I'll get beaten. And this anxiety prohibits growth, it prohibits creativity, it prohibits social relationships, it prohibits trying out different things, exploring, being creative, learning, etc. It's got a lot of consequences, basically. So again, we need to be very careful and not to create this state in a child.
Okay, so we're out of time now. We're talking about parents who beat their children for their misbehavior. We said that there were two very important dangers about this. First of all, the negative association that might be created with religious events that will stay there for a few decades after their childhood even. And secondly, the harm that it does to their self-respect, and that's something that might never go away, and we don't want that to happen. There are alternative ways to beating your children. We didn't have time to cover those in this episode, but we will cover them in the next episode, inshallah. Don't forget to follow up on this program. If you missed our program, don't worry, you can always download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit www.parstoday.com, that's parstoday.com, and find our page on Call of Islam Radio. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ
That is because Allah causes the night to enter the day, and causes the day to enter the night, and because Allah is hearing and seeing.
ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ يُولِجُ اللَّيْلَ فِي النَّهَارِ وَيُولِجُ النَّهَارَ فِي اللَّيْلِ. That is because Allah merges the night into the day, and He merges the day into the night. وَأَنَّ اللَّهَ سَمِيعٌ بَصِيرٌ. And that Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. So, you may remember in the previous program, we talked about the 60th verse, and that the promise of Allah is true, and the promise of aid and help is encouraging and effective. Now, in view of this fact, when it is from the side of an almighty and powerful person, then a part of the infinite power of Allah in the universe is mentioned through this verse. ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ يُولِجُ اللَّيْلَ فِي النَّهَارِ. That is because Allah merges the night into the day. So He constantly decreases from one, and according to a certain system, He adds to another. وَيُولِجُ النَّهَارَ فِي اللَّيْلِ merges the day into the night. This system is a fixed and perfectly accurate one, which has been running for thousands or maybe millions of years. The Arabic term yuliju is derived from ilaj and originally from waluj, which means admission. As we said, this alteration refers to the some kind of gradual and regular and at the same time accurate changes of the day and the night during different seasons of the year, and one of them decreases and the other increases. It is also probable that this refers to the sunrise and sunset, that because of the special circumstances of the atmosphere, which causes the air to surround the earth, this change does not occur suddenly. From early morning, the onset of dawn, the rays of the sun shine the higher levels of the air and slowly transfer to the lower levels of the air. It is as if the day gradually enters into the night, and the forces of light prevail over the army of the darkness. And on the contrary, at the time of sunset, at first the light begins to be somehow vanished from the lower levels of the atmosphere, and it becomes rather dim, and gradually it will be dismissed from the higher and higher levels. And this continues till there will be no ray of the sun, and the army of the darkness occupy everywhere. And if it were not such, the rising of the sun and sunset would happen in a fleeting moment, and the sudden transition of the night to the day, and the day to the night, would be spiritually and physically harmful for the human beings, and this sudden and rapid change would also, of course, cause many difficulties in this social system that we're having. So there is no problem that this holy verse refers to both of the interpretation.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
We shouldn't forget that the power and knowledge of Allah in relation to changing a day and night is a sign for His ability in helping the servants. And this is the point, because the verse says, ذَلِكَ, this helping the people who need aid is because that the Almighty Allah has the power to change the day into night and vice versa. So the change of the day and night is not casual, and the administration of the whole world has a wise and knowing administrator. And at the end, the verse says, and that Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. وَأَنَّ اللَّهَ سَمِيعٌ بَصِيرٌ. This means that Allah hears the request of the believers for help, and He is always aware of their circumstances and their needs, and at the necessary time, His grace will hasten to help them. And in the same way, He is always aware of the deeds and intentions of the enemies of the truth. And in the next verse, there will be mentioned an evidence for what was said in this verse. We will, inshallah, continue to the next verse in the later programs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
European News Bulletin.
I'm Saeed Pereza. Ethnic minorities in the UK are significantly less likely to take the coronavirus vaccine than their white counterparts. According to the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, vaccine hesitancy is highest among black British groups, with 72% stating they would be very unlikely to get the jab. The report added that Pakistani-Bangladeshi groups are the second most reluctant, with 42% saying they're very unlikely to be inoculated. This despite the fact that ethnic minorities are much more susceptible to being diagnosed with coronavirus, as they're more likely to work in risky frontline jobs such as retail and transport. Meanwhile, a doctor working with COVID-19 patients in a London hospital has said his workplace feels like a war zone. Dr. Amir Wahid said healthcare workers were being stretched as the number of people in the UK suffering from coronavirus is increasing every day. On Wednesday, the UK recorded over 1,820 deaths in 24 hours, the highest number of fatalities in a single day since the pandemic began. For more on that, I'm joined by Dr. Ranjit Barar. He is an NHS consultant, physician, and surgeon. Good to see you as always, Dr. Barar. So why do you think ethnic minorities are so resistant to getting the COVID vaccine?
Thank you. Good to be with you. I do think it's cruel, as you say. It's an irony. The ethnic minority population here, Afro-Caribbean population in particular, are amongst the most susceptible, the most likely to have poor outcomes, highest mortality rate. And initially, when we talked about this earlier in the pandemic, we questioned whether there was a genetic susceptibility. We now know that that is not the case, that this is a socioeconomic phenomenon. This is because this section of the population, whilst imperialism is now very keen to paint itself in rainbow colors, Britain is an imperial country, but no longer displays an overt racism in its outward propaganda. But where that systemic racism shows up is in the life chances, in the economic group into which you're more likely to find yourself packaged if you are from a non-white ethnic minority, from an immigrant population. That is the reason why ethnic minorities, Afro-Caribbean, South Asian population are having higher susceptibility, higher rates of virus, because as you say, they're on the front line in lower paid jobs, more likely to be exposed and more likely to live in multi-generational households, more likely to therefore get the virus, more likely to do poorly from the virus. And it's for the same reason that actually these groups have experienced systemic discrimination in our society, and they have systemic mistrust towards almost all institutions. They see it at school, they see it from the prison service, they see it from the police, they see it from the justice system. They're more likely to go to jail, they're less likely to receive good educational outcomes from school.
But
and
that
I'm afraid
mistrust,
to say,
Dr. Barrar,
in the
could
NHS
that also
as well.
Be, you watch the media here, and they're pinning it down to, for example, the pace at which the rollout took place. Some are saying probably this has got to do with people listening to conspiracy theories, especially on social media. What do you think?
I think there's systemic distrust towards our government and our media. There was a recent poll of who was the most trusted and least trusted professions in society. Nurses were the most trusted, having about 90% of the population trust them. Doctors, 87%. Politicians and journalists are below estate agents in our country. They have a kind of 10, 11, 12% of the population believe what they're saying. We've seen systemic levels of corruption, really amounting to fraudulent corruption. Hundreds of billions being spent on bailing out businesses. $5-6 billion on track and trace system that manifestly hasn't worked, $45 billion on testing. All of this leads to a systemic distrust of the government and the media, and especially high amongst those sections of the population who traditionally are not represented and not well served. And this is the problem, really. There's a mistrust in the official sources of information, and then people will turn to unofficial sources of information. That's a phenomenon we're seeing across the country, across Europe, even amongst medical professionals in France and Spain. There's a high levels of mistrust of this vaccine precisely because of the improper financial relationship between the large drug multinationals and governmental institutions. That doesn't mean that we should mistrust the fact that COVID exists. It doesn't mean we should mistrust the vaccine, but I'm afraid that's almost an inevitable outcome of the relationship currently between big business and our government.
And perhaps one way to build trust with the public would be to be more transparent on the part of the government. Dr. Ranjit Barrar, thank you and have a good evening. Staying in this country, Britain's National Health Service, which offers free care, health care to rich and poor alike, is in crisis. Privatization is turning patients into clients and prioritizing profits. Since the start of the pandemic, Britons have been urged to protect the NHS. But campaigners say the British government, not the pandemic, is the healthcare system's worst enemy. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
The COVID-19 pandemic has thrown into stark relief what has been going on behind the scenes of a treasured British institution. The National Health Service has been reduced to a shadow of its former self by defunding and privatisation. The NHS entered the pandemic with a demoralised workforce. Because of new contracts forced through by the government, healthcare professionals have fewer protections, privatisation has led to fewer resources, and staff are actually leaving the NHS, tired of working under what Dr. Gill says are horrendous conditions.
NHS staff feel undervalued. Their terms and conditions of employment, their wages have stagnated since the 2008 crash. In real terms, 15 to 20% pay cut. And under those circumstances, it's very difficult to keep hold of staff. And then we've had the whole Brexit affair, which has alienated European staff.
Before the pandemic hit, the NHS had vacancies for 40,000 nurses and 10,000 doctors. The Tory government is being accused of failing to introduce basic healthcare measures and using the hurried rollout of vaccines to turn the media's attention away from its shortcomings.
We should not be in a third wave. We should never have ever approached tens of thousands of people dying because the government didn't act to save life. It acted to serve business interests, but ideologically they are not in government to save life. They're in government to further the profits of corporations. And, you know, human life is not valued by this government.
At the start of the pandemic, the opposition Labour Party called on ministers to publish the conclusions of a cross-government pandemic drill called Cygnus that took place in 2016. It accurately predicted that a deadly flu-like disease would plunge the NHS into crisis with a severe shortage of personal protective equipment, intensive care beds and ventilators. The drill painted a bleak picture, and only 4 years later, almost all those predictions have come true, with the death toll across the UK approaching 100,000. Bianca Rahimi, London.
We turn away from the UK now. The Biden administration is proposing a 5-year extension to the new START treaty, limiting the number of U.S. and Russian strategic nuclear weapons. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan will convey the extension proposal to Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov. The move is considered an early signal of Biden's intent to pursue arms control and was welcomed by both Russia and key American allies. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has already called on both countries to extend and broaden the treaty. Israeli businessman Benny Steinmetz has spent 2 weeks on trial in Geneva in a case described as the mining sector's biggest ever corruption case. Steinmetz is accused of bribing public officials in the West African country of Guinea in order to gain control of the country's iron ore deposits. Steinmetz denies the charges. The case dates back to 2006 when the prosecution alleges the businessman bribed to the tune of $10 million so his company could acquire sole mining rights.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Should you have to pay more than twice for coronavirus vaccines if you haven't paid into the research that led to their development? Well, that's what South Africa, the continent's worst-hit country, is being asked to do. Ahmed Kabala joins me with all the details. Ahmed, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Yeah, this story has angered many people, particularly when you look at the history of South Africa and Oxford University. Now, Oxford University has one of its most famous alumni as Cecil Rhodes, whose statue sits outside of Oriel College. Now, Cecil Rhodes made his huge fortune through rape, pillage of the Southern African region, which included South Africa, Northern Rhodesia, and Southern Rhodesia, which are today called Zambia and Zimbabwe. And many think it's hypocritical for an Oxford vaccine developed by the Oxford University to charge South Africa, a country which had been it's indebted to so much for a vaccine, more than its European counterparts that have not contributed to the building of Oxford University like South Africa. Now, these tweets from Global Justice Now speak to this. AstraZeneca, what happened to your promise to cap prices to provide COVID-19 vaccines to the widest population with as fair access as possible? And what we've seen through the COVID-19 pandemic is the divisions in society around the world have been exposed. In Palestine, we're seeing a vaccine apartheid being carried out by the Israeli regime. In the UK, we see ethnic minorities disproportionately affected. And now we're seeing the continent, which has been raped and pillaged more than anywhere else, being neglected once again when it comes to the distribution. Lisa Kane, final tweet on this story, says this: will a history professor from the University of Oxford please educate AstraZeneca on Rhodes and on colonialism?
Right, and it completely disregards what the WHO Secretary General had to say, that the priority must be to vaccinate some people in all countries rather than all the people in some countries. Let's move on to South America, Latin America, if you will, and what the U.S. is going to be doing as regards Venezuela and its fake president, Juan Guaido.
Yes, in the liberal mainstream media, we've seen a lot made of the differences between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. But when it comes to foreign policy, we here, with this story, see how much aligned Joe Biden's administration is and will be to Donald Trump's administration, particularly when it comes to Latin America and Venezuela, where they've continued to support the recognition of Juan Guaido, a guy that has never been elected to high office as a so-called president, and continue with the approach of sanctions. So you've got this tweet from Joe Biden's official Twitter account that he put out in September before he was elected, indicating how it was not going to change. He says, as Juan Guaido speaks about the Venezuelan humanitarian crisis and the crimes against humanity perpetrated by Maduro, I reaffirm my commitment to stand with the Venezuelan people. A Biden-Harris administration will always champion democracy and human rights around the world. Now, Chris Williamson, a former Labour MP, says, Biden continues where Trump left off. Whoever's in the White House, nothing changes. The US continues to be an anti-democratic imperialist empire that poses a threat to peace around the world. Viva Venezuela. And final point on this, we've heard a lot made of the Capitol riots and the threat to democracy that Donald Trump has supposedly represents. But the US is the greatest threat to democracy and stability around the world, and it's proven that by continuing to support an unelected puppet that has never stood for any presidential elections.
All right, Press TV's Ahmed Kabbala with those stories.
As well as most other social media platforms, following claims from the companies in question that he had incited the violence witnessed at the U.S. Capitol. However, as many rejoiced at the news that Trump was being deprived of his platform to deliver his many hateful views, others warned of the precedent now set for anti-establishment figures and news outlets. Following the incident, much praise was leveled at social media giants for their collective move to silence Donald Trump on their platforms, especially those aligned with the U.S. Democratic Party. However, this seemingly small win for left-wingers on social media was quickly met with sharp criticism from those outside of the United States. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was perhaps the most high-profile figure to have spoken out against Twitter, citing the move as problematic and a violation of fundamental rights to free speech. The German leader was not alone on the global scene, with the UK Premier Boris Johnson calling for a real debate to take place on the issue of social media freedoms, as the Polish government plans to make censoring social media accounts illegal. But beyond the mainstream debates on the issue, what is perhaps more important is to discuss what the real result of Trump's social media ban has paved the way for. The first issue that was almost completely ignored by those advocating for the ban was the prospect of the ban itself causing a further radicalization of Trump supporters. President Donald Trump has, since the election results were announced, been claiming on a daily basis that the election was a sham and that there was widespread voter fraud. This issue had even gotten to such a point that Trump loyalists were willing to abandon their traditional home at right-wing channels such as Fox News for simply acknowledging that Joe Biden was president-elect. The second major issue with the censoring of Trump and many of his supporters on social media has been that big tech companies have begun to come after anyone now that doesn't have the Western mainstream establishment line. This has resulted in the targeting of Press TV's official Facebook page, which built up a following of almost 4 million people, along with the targeting of many prominent anti-war voices. Let's be clear, what happened at the U.S. Capitol was violent and in no way representative of the so-called peace-loving democracy concept that the United States loves to market to the rest of the Western world. But despite this, the U.S. president has been getting away with directly inciting violence throughout his presidency, including during the 2020 BLM protests when he instructed police via Twitter to use excessive force. If this move was truly about ending calls from leaders, which could be interpreted as inciting violence, then why was Trump's account able to remain all throughout last year? Also, why was Trump able to threaten Iran openly over Twitter, claiming that he would violate international law by striking 52 sites, including cultural targets? Finally, if this move was an act on compassionate grounds by social media companies, then why are the accounts of Barack Obama and George Bush still around? War criminals, literal coup leaders, murderers, and convicted sex offenders are allowed to have access to social media platforms. If these companies are consistent, isn't it time for them to take down virtually every single Western leader from their outlets? Because if they are so opposed to the incitement of coups, Britain, France, the US, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel should all have their leaders purged.
More stories in this segment, starting with Thursday's deadly twin blasts in central Baghdad that was claimed by Daesh terrorists. The country's prime minister has vowed an earth-shattering response. Robert Carter has been following that story for us, and he joins me now to tell us what's happening in Iraq. Good evening, Robert.
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously, I'm sure everyone's seen the news. Twin deadly suicide bombing attack hitting the capital there in Baghdad, targeting a civilian area, a marketplace in the busy capital streets. And of course, well over 30 people killed, many others injured. It's just become commonplace in Iraq, unfortunately, these types of incidents. And, you know, with the news that Daesh is still active in Iraq, it, of course, causes massive concern. The Iraqi government has, of course, promised a strong response. The prime minister has vowed not to allow further incidents like this to happen again. And the government has held emergency meetings on finding ways to discuss how they can improve the security situation in Iraq. But ultimately, what's caused a lot of anger online is the fact that Joe Biden has only just entered into the White House.
And Robert, before you move on, some are saying that all of this is happening. This is like some kind of a fight between the different political groups ahead of the elections in the country. Others, as you yourself said earlier on, this was something that was carried out by Daesh that is said to be resurgent in Iraq. They're probably not in the rural areas at the moment, but they are coming back.
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying, is that, you know, could there be some kind of Daesh revival in the country? And now that the new U.S. president is in, it seems as if his solution to this pending threat is to send more U.S. troops back to the country. And that's something that we know the Iraqi people certainly don't want. And that has been reflected on social media as well, Saeed. Let's go to the first tweet. I can actually bring it up now. It's from Khalid Baydoun, who says, prayers, of course, with the victims of the bombings in Baghdad. The Daesh claims bombings killed 32 people and injured 100 plus more. Why isn't this getting more media coverage? Because the victims of terror are Muslim, Arab, and poor. And then Hadi Nasrallah brings up the point I've mentioned, which is a day after Biden became president, two horrific suicide attacks targeted civilians in a busy market in Baghdad. Now Biden wants to send more troops to Iraq. Surprise, surprise. Lest we forget that Biden was essential in the destruction of Iraq and the rise of Daesh to begin with. I think that ultimately is a vital point that needs to be mentioned more.
All right, let's move on to your second story, if we can. And that's got to do with French atrocities in Algeria before 1962, when they gained independence. The French are saying they acknowledge it, that war crimes took place, but they don't think it was brutal enough to warrant an apology.
Yes, absolutely. So Macron, of course, is not really within the Muslim world's good books as of last year, when he essentially launched an anti-Muslim crackdown inside France's borders. But one ongoing bloody legacy of France is its imperialist conquests in Muslim lands. And of course, the war for independence in Algeria was just one of the darkest periods in French history, where essentially millions of Algerians were butchered by French occupation forces. And decades later, that still resonates within Algerian society today. Now, Macron has essentially, when asked, admitted that he has no plans to apologize at all for the crimes.
But Robert, let me interrupt you there, but why is he not apologizing? I mean, he's not the only president who is not doing it. Successive French presidents, from Jacques Chirac to Sarkozy to Hollande, they all stop short of issuing a formal apology. They've only said they acknowledge the fact that brutalities happened during those years.
It's difficult to say. There could be many factors in this. Of course, France is, if you look at the voting record, there is a rise in far-right sentiment, anti-immigration sentiment, anti-Muslim sentiment in the French electorate. If Macron was to appease Algeria in this sense, then it's quite likely that his support base could take a real hit as right-wing voters turn away from Macron, who perhaps would be seen as too pro Algeria, too pro-Muslim, too pro-minority from this move. So he's turned very right-wing over the past couple of years. But also, if he issues an apology for this, what comes next? Algeria will surely demand reparations. There, I'm sure there'll be other minorities and other countries which
that,
France
that is
devastated.
A very valid point, Robert. Let's let social media users weigh in on this as well.
Absolutely. So some very important points being raised. First, from Impact UK, which is a UK-based Muslim advocacy group, they say France will not apologize. Well, France doesn't just need to apologize. They need to pay back all the wealth that they stole. So pushing for reparations there. And then Ben Norton, a journalist based in the US, comes in saying, in Algeria's war for independence against 120 years of colonialism, France killed 1 million Algerians, sent 2 million more to concentration camps, and tortured countless. But neoliberal President Macron declares there will be no apology. And I think that that sums up the whole story here. The very least the Algerians need are reparations. I don't think they particularly want an apology.
Right, Robert Carter with those stories. Robert, thanks a lot. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this broadcast.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be asking a question and attempting to answer it. The question that we want to ask today is the following. Why is it that God is the sole being who has the right to be obeyed? We know that God, we have to obey God, but why is it that God is the only being that we must obey? The answer to this question is very simple. We can answer this question by saying that the person who rules and governs over another person or another being must be obeyed. In other words, if somebody has the power to rule and govern somebody, but it's not, if we say that it's not necessary to obey him, his governance and his rule becomes of no benefit. The only time that his rule and his governance over this person or this being has some benefit, if he has, if it becomes necessary to obey him. Otherwise, if this person gives an order and says to this other person, you must perform this task or you must not do such and such a task, and it's not necessary for this person to obey him, what's the purpose of his rule? So, we can come to the following conclusion, that the person who has authority and has the power to legitimately rule over another being must be obeyed. So this is a general law and a general and a universal proposition that we've understood through reason. On the other hand, we know that God is the sole being who has essential and essential and principal authority and governance over other people. Because as we might have mentioned in some of our previous sessions, that God is the sole creator of the universe, therefore he's the owner of the universe and the being that regulates them. He therefore has authority over them, over their lives, over their wealth, etc. And therefore he has the power to rule them and govern them. And based upon the general principle that we just mentioned, we can say that because he has the power to rule them and govern them, and he's the hakim over them, he should be and must be obeyed. he should be muta, he should be obeyed by the people he governs, by the beings that he governs. But at the same time, as we mentioned in some of our previous sessions, God's governance over the affairs of other people and his rule over them is manifested in the form of his appointing a human being to govern and rule over these people, because it's necessary for the person who governs another being to be similar to him, so that he can exemplify in his existence the rules and prohibitions that he gives them. From this, we can come to another conclusion, and that's this: that it's also necessary for this person who God appoints as a ruler and gives permission to rule over other people, it's necessary for this person to be obeyed, because he also has an authority to govern and rule over them. But just like his governance is through the permission of God, the necessity of his obedience is also by the permission of God. In Surah An-Nisa, verse 64, God Almighty says the following: Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِن رَسُولٍ إِلَّا لَيُطَاءَ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. We did not send any prophet except that he should be obeyed by the permission of God. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. We were looking at God's governance and rule, and the necessity of obeying him and listening to him. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see,